reaching into your community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
In a few minutes, we're going to have the very latest in space and astronomy news, because this now is the Space Show. We can fly aeroplanes to the other side of the world and back within 10 minutes of scheduled time. But it's a little hard to get a slider here to work without scratching. So let's just fade down, Vangelis, and welcome you to the Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie, and
I'm Michael Abdillah,
and we're co-hosting the show tonight. You may have realised that in past days I was overseas, and now back on deck, and lots of news to share with you about the American space program. Now, Michael, you're about to head off. It's sort of like hello, goodbye.
That's
hello,
right,
I'm
Andrew.
Back, and goodbye, Michael. You're off.
That's right. Yep. Three of us are leaving for the U.S. next week to watch the launch of the shuttle Atlantis, which is scheduled for May 14.
And I can personally confirm, having stood just a few metres from her, that she is on the launch pad attached to her orange external tank and the two solid rocket boosters, and the astronauts have practised their their liftoff procedures and so on, and they're now back in Houston, and they'll be back in time, I hope, for your flight. So, yes, I can personally confirm the Atlantis is there ready for you to go and look at it.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you.
And meanwhile, I was able to see the launch of the space shuttle STS-131, which was the vehicle called Discovery. I nearly said Endeavour. Endeavour's the one shuttle I didn't see. There's three shuttles left, and Endeavour was in its orbital processing facility, and I didn't get to see her. However, I saw the Discovery being launched, and I saw her land, and I saw her being wheeled back into the orbital processing facility. And what a wonderful sight that vehicle is. Looking a bit worse for wear, though. It's obviously a used vehicle. It's got lots of bumps and nicks out of it, and a lot of dirt around the access hatch in particular. So Atlantis is in the same condition. It's obviously a used spaceship.
Absolutely, we saw some photographs of the of Atlantis as it was being rolled out into the VAB. And yes, there were certainly evidence of some millions of miles travelled in that craft. Amazingly, when Atlantis is rolled out to the launch pad with those beautiful bright lights, it looks just perfect and pristine and magical from here anyway. Mm. It may not have looked so pristine from where you were standing.
No, I was up very close to it. I was actually amazed. I think I mentioned that the other day when we were talking on air when I was in Florida, that I was surprised I even got inside the building, and even more surprised when they didn't shoo us out of the building and it started moving. And it rolled out into the black of the night.
Yeah,
and then they turned the xenon lights on, big bright xenon lights. And I got some nice little silhouette photos as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was quite an experience.
I can imagine.
All right. The other thing that happened when I was there was the launch of a secret, I use the inverted commas, not really a secret, but the media over there was calling it a secret space plane. And it was the X-37B, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And it was launched on an Atlas rocket. And I'd seen that rocket sitting on the pad ever since I arrived at the Kennedy Space Center. And I hoped that I'd be allowed to remain there while they launched it. And it was a spectacular sight. It was an evening launch, unlike the shuttle which I saw being launched, the STS-131, which was a morning launch before dawn, about an hour before dawn. This one was just after the sunset. And again, it ascended into the daylight. And the plume changed colour again, and because it was launching, our sky was dark, you could see it way up in the sky, and you could even see the payload fairing come off. Now, they protect the payload. The payload's the actual thing they're trying to put into space, and they surround it by what they call a fairing to stop the air resistance as it ascends through the lower atmosphere from destroying the very delicate spacecraft that's inside it. And once they get clear into the stratosphere, they're clear of enough atmosphere to be able to jettison that. And the reason they do it there is that you don't want to carry anything up into space that you don't want in space, because it's just costs too much fuel to do so. So it's a bit like campers, you know, not carrying empty cans with them. They burn, bash and bury if they're not going to carry them back out. So we saw this payload fairing separate. At least those of us who have keen eyesight. Well, my eyes aren't all that good these days, but I did still see it. So it was a wonderful, wonderful sight. And that is a space plane which was initially developed by NASA and then transferred over to the Air Force. And the idea was that it was going to be used to return things from the space station. It would be launched, initially it's going to be launched inside the main space shuttle. And later they transferred it to the Air Force, and they now launch it on an expendable vehicle, which is the Atlas V rocket. And the idea is that it can stay in space for many months, up to about 180 days, nearly 6 months, I forget the exact figure now. And it can stay in space for that length of time and then be commanded to return. And it's going to return to the Edwards Air Force Base mm-hmm. in California. Although some people are talking about extending the skid strip, as they call it, which is an airport on the Kennedy, not on the Kennedy Space Center where the shuttle lands, but on Cape Canaveral Air Force Station.
Okay.
And there's a separate field there. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about expanding that. Now, this is not official talk, I might add. It's just talk amongst the news media who are pretty clued up on what's happening there. So we're going to have a feature about that in a forthcoming space show. It depends on how your mission goes, STS-132, as to when we schedule that in. But we have got a whole lot of details about the craft. I have my own description of the launch as I recorded it live at the time. And people who want to see that can come to the Space Association meeting tomorrow evening, and we'll be seeing some pictures of that launch there. And that meeting, we'll just say that now because we might forget to say it later on, is at the Oakley RSL, which is in Drummond Street, Oakley, immediately opposite the public library. So Drummond Street, Oakley, very near public transport, and there's plenty of car parking in the street outside. So that's it's there. And the meeting starts at 7 o'clock. And run through to about 9 o'clock, and there we'll be looking at possibly a video of President Obama, and certainly lots and lots of pictures of the current space shuttle mission. Well, I say the current one's now landed, but the current one as well, which is STS-132. By the way, the STS-132 basically the next mission starts when they start rolling the vehicle back to the orbiter processing facility. So, Michael's, your mission is officially underway right
that's
now.
That's right, that's right.
Even though it's sitting on the launch pad as it has been driven out. It was rather fun to see the commander of that mission driving the Caller transporter. And the Caller transporter goes at about, well, a very slow walking speed. It takes many hours to get out to the launch pad, and it was driven there by the Space Shuttle Commander. Well, driven part of the way anyway, if not the whole way. And he's sure as heck going to be driving the Space Shuttle a lot faster when they light the wick and up she goes there in the middle of May.
Absolutely.
So what else are you planning to do when you're over there?
The main event is the launch of Atlantis. We're going to take in some of the other space-related sites and museums and things around Cape Canaveral and the Kennedy Space Center and so on. And if we're really lucky and feeling adventurous, we were hoping to make a trip up to Washington, D.C. to see the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum and some of the other sites of Washington. So that's the plan. We'll see how it unfolds in the coming weeks.
My plan had also been to go up to Washington and maybe do some interviews and things with folks at the Goddard Space Flight Center, but there's so much happening down at Cape Canaveral and the Kennedy Space Center that I just didn't go.
Absolutely. You were a very busy boy, and we were very very envious of all the opportunities you had over there. It was fantastic to get your reports on a weekly basis, so thanks for that, Andrew.
Now, the other thing that happened when I was over there was the President of the United States, Barack Obama, came to the Kennedy Space Center, and he gave us a talk on the future of the American space program. Now, I wouldn't compare this in any way to Kennedy's vision, we shall go to the moon speech, but, well, it does set the a less grandiose view of what might happen in space. Now, before that happened, I had a chance to talk with Edward Crawley. He was a member of the Augustine Commission that decided to do away with the Moon, Mars and Beyond program that had been instituted by President Bush. And out of that inquiry, the Moon, Mars and Beyond Commission, came the Constellation Project, which, as Michael knows here, was a plan to use two rockets, a big one called Ares 5 and a small one called Ares 1, to launch a manned spacecraft which would initially link up with the International Space Station, but it could also go to the Moon and, well, maybe could have gone beyond. But Barack Obama has put the kibosh on that because of a report that was prepared by Augustine and others. And Edward Crawley was a part of that. And we have here a discussion which myself and several other reporters had with Ed Crawley about that. By the way, in his day job, Ed Crawley is a professor of engineering at MIT, and I only just found this out now, a few minutes ago. In 1980, he was a finalist for astronaut selection. So here's Ed Crawley talking just minutes before Barack Obama spoke at the Kennedy Space Center.
So if you look at the Merchant 7, or however many you want to say are out there, who would you put your money on to be the first to fly humans into orbit?
I don't think I have enough information to answer that.
They'll make it in the next 3 or 4 years?
I think that there's a reasonable likelihood that, as we said in the Augustine report, that someone would be able to do it by about 15. I mean, I think I'll be consistent with that date because I have no reason to change it. We heard from the potential builders that, some said 3 years, some said 4 years, some said 5 than you expect. We figured there'd be a year of program realignment, which clearly there is a year of program realignment. And, in time, there'd be a fair competition. But if you read our report of last summer or last fall, the Augustine report, we're pretty explicit that this has to be a well-crafted acquisition. That it has to be an acquisition that gives the private suppliers enough confidence that there'll be a market and enough confidence that NASA will not treat it as a normal acquisition and, turn it into that mode.
Thanks very much.
We didn't mention 135.
I'm sorry?
We didn't mention 135.
I don't know.
What's his point today?
Well, I think the president is going to really try and create the vision that didn't quite come out in the budget. You know, that there's this new strategy for exploration. And as I've said to the media all week, it wasn't very well articulated. It was not well articulated. And I think that, you know, today's the day for the president to do that.
It's a correction.
No, I don't think it's a correction. I think it's very unfortunate that this new vision for space exploration came out as part of the budget. You know, because budgets are about numbers and details, and it's not a place where it's easy to express a new vision and a new strategy. So this is the place to do it. You put the President of the United States on the podium, you let him speak, you know. Rice University.
Why not?
I think that, frankly, the attention of the administration has been focused on other major issues, healthcare, nuclear disarmament, Afghanistan, and I think it's time for the president to take this one on.
Do you see us getting back to the moon and onto Mars?
I see us getting onto Mars, and I think the moon will be a test flight. I think that I commissioned last summer, as part of the Augustine panel, a study that was attempted to answer this question. If you knew you were going to Mars, what would you do on the moon? Which is a very different question than, let's go to the moon and see what we think we can do for Mars. And the answer came back from NASA. If you know you're going to Mars, what you do is you'd use the moon as a test flight, or a series of test flights. But you would actually build the systems that you would use to go to Mars, and then slightly modify them and go to the moon. So it would be Gemini. You know, the moon would be Gemini for Mars.
Any chance of going to any of the asteroids as a training?
Well, the near-Earth objects, certainly. The most obvious destination and the easiest destination to reach outside of the Earth-Moon system is the near-Earth objects, which have very modest energy requirements to get to them. And and they make a good intermediate step. The near-Earth object missions are 6 months, 3 months to 6 months in duration. That's, you don't want to go around the moon for 3 or 6 months. Mars is 2 or 3 years. You know, it's sort of a good intermediate mission to fly to.
Why should the American public be excited about the new presidential plan?
Well, I'll tell you why I think it wasn't excited about the old one, which, you know, my colleagues, the commanders of the Apollo flights, wrote this nice letter, heartfelt letter, this week, and they said it exactly right, that the Apollo program inspired a generation of Americans, you know, but here we are, you know, that generation is us, and we have to have a mission that will inspire the youth of America to engage them in the media that they're used to engaging with. You know, why can't we Twitter to the astronauts on the way to Mars and things, you know? So what the president will lay out today, I think, is a progression of exploratory missions that actually go to new places and do new things, and a mechanism for doing it that actually engages the American people, and especially the youth, in a medium that they're used to working in.
Can this new strategy bring about some change in the division of labor in the aerospace exploration among the countries?
Yes. I think that there's a subtle point built into the president's plan, which is that part of the reason I think that he's not immediately announcing, you know, specific destinations and specific programs and specific vehicles is that we heard very clearly from the international community that they wanted to be engaged in helping make this vision, that they really wanted a global enterprise of exploration of space, and they didn't want to be told by the Americans what the Americans were doing and then asked if they could join. So by allowing a little bit of planning time here, not only are we allowing NASA to develop the technology, but we're allowing the deliberation at the intergovernmental level to take place. And I think that'll be very important for the long term. The Augustine Committee was pretty firm on the point that this should be a global enterprise, led by America, a way of America for you know, being a leader in the world community. But as of this date, the sum of the space budgets of our partners exceeds the space budgets of NASA. So there's capability and there's financial resources in those communities that's very important, and it's very important that this be a partnership. Okay, I probably ought to get back there. Thank you.
And at that point, he got shooed away and called away to because the official proceedings were about to start. Now, as I said, he was a member of the Augustine committee that prepared the report that ended the Constellation program. It was Obama that decided that. Now, as a result of that decision, there is a lot of unhappiness, especially in Florida, which heavily relies not just on tourism, but on the space industry. There are a large number of industries in the area, and there are lots of people who work on the Kennedy Space Center itself. So they were really ropeable, and the whole idea of having Obama come was to smooth over troubled waters. Well, I don't know if it quite worked, because speaking to people afterwards, and we'll hear some of them on the space show, future space shows, they were very, very unhappy. A lot of people are unhappy with Bill Nelson. Now, you've heard of Bill Nelson. He's a, Michael, he's a U.S. senator, and he flew on a space shuttle called STS-61C in 1986 January, which is the flight just before the ill-fated Challenger mission, and he orbited the Earth for 97 orbits. Now, he was a representative at that time, but he's now a senator. Well, you'll hear differently in this talk, but the locals there say he's done basically nothing for the space program. Many people told me that. He's not very highly thought of by many people that I spoke to. However, he is praised in this talk. Well, he introduces Charlie Bolden, who is the current NASA administrator. And he was the pilot on STS-61C. Now, we just mentioned that. That's the space shuttle that Bill Nelson flew on. So you hear a reference to that as well, that Charlie Bolden flew Bill Nelson. And he's now the NASA administrator. Charlie Bolden, if I remember correctly, has been in space, I think, four times on four different shuttle missions. And Charlie Bolden is the one who introduces Barack Obama, who just happens to be the President of the United States. Now, Michael, you played part of this speech by Obama in a previous show while I was away. And we're going to hear now the entire speech. As I heard it, it was very hard to hear because it was in a very reverberant room. In fact, it was a payload processing facility where materials are prepared for it to go up. The Hubble Space Telescope, for example, was prepared in this room, and Obama refers to the Orion spacecraft, which is going to be prepared in that room. Well, it's like speaking in a mosque or a cathedral where sound just reverberates. So I myself didn't hear it very well. Plus the fact that I was standing behind the speakers, which were the president's own speakers, White House speakers, and they are very efficient at putting the sound forward and very inefficient at putting the sound backwards.
You're trying to tell me that he travels with his own speaker system.
He travels with his own speaker system, yes. Okay. And his own mixing control and his own White House or AV equipment. And I got shooed out of one place because I was going to be standing in the line of sight between the AV, the White House AV set, and the president. And that was just not going to be allowed. So I got shooed away to another posse, which actually turned out to be a much better place to stand in, because now I was standing closer to him and I was standing on the side. So, yeah, it was quite good. So, and the people who were in the official audience said that they couldn't hear him well either. Okay, then, we shall... I must apologise. Michael and I have been talking here and I didn't have Michael's phone on. That's what going to America does to you. It addles the brain. Sorry, Michael.
That's okay.
So your comments have not been going to air. Now then, we're going to play the entire speech here. First, Bill Nelson introducing Charlie Bolden, who in turn introduces Barack Obama. I never adjusted to American time properly because a lot of things I was doing were in the middle of the night, which is when it was daytime here in Australia.
yes, we noticed that.
I got whacked out of thing and I never really got into American time. All right, let's see how we go now. Let's try this.
The man I'm about to introduce is a patriot, a leader, and a visionary. He's also someone who knows the importance of America being the leader in science and technology through space exploration. He's been there, done that. He's a Marine general, an aviator, a test pilot who flew more than 100 missions in Vietnam. He's an astronaut and a veteran of 4 space shuttle flights. I've known him the better part of a quarter of a century. On our space flight, I trusted him with my life, and I would do so again. Ladies and gentlemen, the administrator of NASA, Charlie Bolden.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you for coming out today, as difficult as it may have been to get here. It's good to see a lot of you, and I want to welcome all of you to the Kennedy Space Center. This is a place that's quite close to my heart, and it's a place like no other place on the planet, to be quite honest. It's a place that has, of course, a storied history, being the launch site of so many of humanity's most ambitious and even audacious endeavors, but also a place that has, I can assure you, a storied future. I'm here today to introduce a man who, more than anyone I've met in my career as an officer of Marines and a NASA astronaut, is committed to the arrival of that vibrant future. As the space community knows very well, dreams don't become a reality through wishful thinking alone, much less through highfalutin talk. And even though a steady flow of federal funding may help, that doesn't make things happen. To come true, dreams need to be tested in the crucible of practicality, trial, and error. They need to be calibrated and thought through in painstaking detail so that all the pieces are certain to work together. In this case, to lift us physically, and I dare say emotionally and even spiritually, into the deep frontier, the star-studded universe that all of us are so anxious to explore. The thing that has me so excited about the path forward today is that the man I'm about to introduce understands how critical it is to get that process right. To put it into place, an inspired but methodical plan that can really work for America and for the thousands of workers who every day are straining at the bit and giving their best to stretch the boundaries of what humanity can call home. I'm talking about a president who has, even in these tough economic times, has recognized the value of science, engineering, and innovation to this nation's future, to its economy, its health, its national security, and who, in his short tenure, has already, through his budgets and the Recovery Act, lifted the federal investment in civilian research and development to unprecedented heights. A president who has declared that it is essential for our students to get better science and engineering educations, and who has not just said so, but has put into place and obtained generous funding for programs to get them there. A president who has brought hundreds of students into the White House lawn to look through telescopes and meet astronauts like Buzz Aldrin and Sally Ride. And you better believe, from the looks on those kids' faces, they recognize the power of space to inspire. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my greatest honor to introduce to you a man for whom I have the greatest personal respect and admiration. A man who absolutely has the right stuff to lead us into a new era of exploration and discovery. Please join me in welcoming the President of the United States, President Barack Obama.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Please have a seat. Thank you. I want to thank Senator Bill Nelson and NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden for their extraordinary leadership. I want to recognize Dr. Buzz Aldrin as well, who's in the house. Four decades ago, Buzz became a legend, but in the four decades since, he's also been one of America's leading visionaries and authorities on human spaceflight. A few people, President Company excluded, can claim the expertise of Buzz and Bill and Charlie when it comes to space exploration. I have to say that few people are as singularly unimpressed by Air Force One as those three. Sure, it's comfortable, but it can't even reach low Earth orbit. And that obviously is in striking contrast to the Falcon 9 rocket we just saw on the launch pad, which will be tested for the very first time in the coming weeks. A couple of other acknowledgments I want to make. We've got Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas visiting us, a big supporter of the space program. My director, Office of Science and Technology Policy, in other words, my chief science advisor, John Holdren, is here. And most of all, I want to acknowledge your Congresswoman, Suzanne Cosmos, because every time I meet with her, including the flight down here, she reminds me of how important our NASA programs are and how important this facility is. And she is fighting for every single one of you and for her district and for the jobs in her district. And you should know that you've got a great champion in Congresswoman Cosmos. Please give her a big round of applause. I also want to thank everybody for participating in today's conference. And gathered here are scientists, engineers, business leaders, public servants, and a few more astronauts as well. And last but not least, I want to thank the men and women of NASA for welcoming me to the Kennedy Space Center and for your contributions not only to America but to the world. Here at the Kennedy Space Center, we are surrounded by monuments and milestones of those contributions. It was from here that NASA launched the missions of Mercury and Gemini and Apollo. It was from here that Space Shuttle Discovery, piloted by Charlie Bolden, carried the Hubble telescope into orbit, allowing us to plumb the deepest recesses of our galaxy. And I should point out, by the way, that in my private office, just off the oval, I've got the picture of Jupiter from the Hubble. So thank you, Charlie, for helping to decorate my office. It was from here that men and women, propelled by sheer nerve and talent, set about pushing the boundaries of humanity's reach. That's the story of NASA. And it's a story that started a little more than half a century ago, far from the space coast in a remote and desolate region of what is now called Kazakhstan. Because it was from there that the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth, which was little more than a few pieces of metal with a transmitter and a battery strapped to the top of a missile. But the world was stunned. Americans were dumbfounded. The Soviets, it was perceived, had taken the lead in a race for which we were not yet fully prepared. But we caught up very quickly. President Eisenhower signed legislation to create NASA and to invest in science and math education from grade school to graduate school. In 1961, President Kennedy boldly declared before a joint session of Congress that the United States would send a man to the moon and return him safely to the Earth within a decade. And as a nation, we set about meeting that goal, reaping rewards that have, in the decades since, touched every facet of our lives. NASA was at the forefront. Many gave their careers to the effort, and some have given far more. In the years that have followed, the space race inspired a generation of scientists and innovators, including, I'm sure, many of you. It's contributed to immeasurable technological advances that have improved our health and well-being, from satellite navigation to water purification, from aerospace manufacturing to medical imaging. Although I have to say, during a meeting right before I came out on stage, somebody said, you know, it's more than just Tang, and I had to point out, I actually really like Tang. I thought that was very cool. And leading the world to space helped America achieve new heights of prosperity here on Earth, while demonstrating the power of a free and open society to harness the ingenuity of its people. And on a personal note, I have been part of that generation so inspired by the space program. 1961 was the year of my birth, the year that Kennedy made his announcement. Now, one of my earliest memories is sitting on my grandfather's shoulders, waving a flag as astronauts arrived in Hawaii. For me, the space program has always captured an essential part of what it means to be an American, reaching for new heights, stretching beyond what previously did not seem possible. And so, as president, I believe that space exploration is not a luxury, it's not an afterthought in America's quest for a brighter future. It is an essential part of that quest. So today I'd like to talk about the next chapter in this story. Now, the challenges facing our space program are different, and our imperatives for this program are different than in decades past. We're no longer racing against an adversary. We're no longer competing to achieve a singular goal like reaching the moon. In fact, what was once a global competition has long since become a global collaboration. But while the measure of our achievements has changed a great deal over the past 50 years, what we do or fail to do in seeking new frontiers is no less consequential for our future in space and here on Earth. So let me start by being extremely clear. I am 100% committed to the mission of NASA and its future. Because broadening our capabilities in space will continue to serve our society in ways that we can scarcely imagine. Because exploration will once more inspire wonder in a new generation, sparking passions and launching careers. And because ultimately, if we fail to press forward in the pursuit of discovery, we are ceding our future and we are ceding that essential element of the American character. Now, I know there have been a number of questions raised about my administration's plan for space exploration, especially in this part of Florida where so many rely on NASA as a source of income as well as a source of pride and community. And these questions come at a time of transition, as the space shuttle nears its scheduled retirement after almost 30 years of service. And understandably, this adds to the worries of folks concerned not only about their own futures, but about the future of the space program to which they've devoted their lives. But I also know that underlying these concerns is a deeper worry, one that precedes not only this plan, but this administration. It stems from the sense that people in Washington, driven sometimes less by vision than by politics, have for years neglected NASA's mission and undermined the work of the professionals who fulfill it. We've seen that in the NASA budget, which has risen and fallen with the political winds. But we can also see it in other ways, in the reluctance of those who hold office to set clear, achievable objectives, to provide the resources to meet those objectives, and to justify not just these plans, but the larger purpose of space exploration in the 21st century. All that has to change. And with the strategy I'm outlining today, it will. We start by increasing NASA's budget by $6 billion over the next 5 years. I want people to understand the context of this. This is happening even as we have instituted a freeze on discretionary spending and sought to make cuts elsewhere in the budget. So NASA, from the start, several months ago when I issued my budget, was one of the areas where we didn't just maintain a freeze, but we actually increased funding by $6 billion. By doing that, we will ramp up robotic exploration of the solar system, including a probe of the sun's atmosphere, new scouting missions to Mars and other destinations, and an advanced telescope to follow Hubble, allowing us to peer deeper into the universe than ever before. We will increase Earth-based observation to improve our understanding of our climate and our world, science that will garner tangible benefits, helping us to protect our environment for future generations. And we will extend the life of the International Space Station, likely by more than 5 years, while actually using it for its intended purpose, conducting advanced research that can help improve the daily lives of people here on Earth, as well as testing and improving upon our capabilities in space. This includes technologies like more efficient life support systems that will help reduce the cost of future missions. And in order to reach the space station, we will work with a growing array of private companies competing to make getting to space easier and more affordable. Now, I recognize that some have said it is unfeasible or unwise to work with the private sector in this way. I disagree. The truth is, NASA has always relied on private industry to help design and build the vehicles that carry astronauts to space, from the Mercury capsule that carried John Glenn into orbit nearly 50 years ago, to the Space Shuttle Discovery currently orbiting overhead. By buying the services of space transportation, rather than the vehicles themselves, we can continue to ensure rigorous safety standards are met, but we will also accelerate the pace of innovations as companies, from young startups to established leaders, compete to design and build and launch new means of carrying people and materials out of our atmosphere. In addition, as part of this effort, we will build on the good work already done on the Orion crew capsule. I've directed Charlie Bolden to immediately begin developing a rescue vehicle using this technology so we are not forced to rely on foreign providers if it becomes necessary to quickly bring our people home from the International Space Station. And this Orion effort will be part of the technological foundation for advanced spacecraft to be used in future deep space missions. In fact, Orion will be readied for flight right here in this room. Next, we will invest more than $3 billion to conduct research on an advanced heavy lift rocket, a vehicle to efficiently send into orbit the crew capsules, propulsion systems, and large quantities of supplies needed to reach deep space. In developing this new vehicle, we will not only look at revising or modifying older models, we want to look at new designs, new materials, new technologies that will transform not just where we can go, but what we can do when we get there. And we will finalize a rocket design no later than 2015 and then begin to build it. And I want everybody to understand, that's at least 2 years earlier than previously planned. And that's conservative, given that the previous program was behind schedule and over budget. At the same time, after decades of neglect, we will increase investment right away in other groundbreaking technologies that will allow astronauts to reach space sooner and more often, to travel farther and faster for less cost, and to live and work in space for longer periods of time more safely. That means tackling major scientific and technological challenges. Now, how do we shield astronauts from radiation on longer missions? How do we harness resources on distant worlds? How do we supply spacecraft with energy needed for these far-reaching journeys? These are questions that we can answer and will answer. And these are the questions whose answers no doubt will reap untold benefits right here on Earth. So the point is, what we're looking for is not just to continue on the same path, we want to leap into the future. We want major breakthroughs, a transformative agenda for NASA. Now, yes, pursuing this new strategy will require that we revise the old strategy. In part, this is because the old strategy, including the Constellation program, was not fulfilling its promise in many ways. That's not just my assessment. That's also the assessment of a panel of respected nonpartisan experts charged with looking at these issues closely. Now, despite this, some have had harsh words for the decisions we've made, including some individuals who I've got enormous respect and admiration for. But what I hope is that everybody will take a look at what we are planning, consider the details of what we've laid out, and see the merits as I've described them. The bottom line is, nobody is more committed to manned spaceflight, to human exploration of space, than I am. But we've got to do it in a smart way, and we can't just keep on doing the same old things that we've been doing and thinking that somehow is going to get us to where we want to go. Some have said, for instance, that this plan gives up our leadership in space by failing to produce plans within NASA to reach low Earth orbit instead of relying on companies in other countries. But we will actually reach space faster and more often under this new plan in ways that will help us improve our technological capacity and lower our costs, which are both essential for the long-term sustainability of spaceflight. In fact, through our plan, we'll be sending many more astronauts to space over the next decade. There are also those who've criticized our decision to end parts of Constellation as one that will hinder space exploration below low Earth orbit. But it's precisely by investing in groundbreaking research and innovative companies that we will have the potential to rapidly transform our capabilities, even as we build on the important work already completed through projects like Orion for future missions. And unlike the previous program, we are setting a course with specific and achievable milestones. Early in the next decade, a set of crewed flights will test and prove the systems required for exploration beyond low Earth orbit. And by 2025, we expect new spacecraft designed for long journeys to allow us to begin the first ever crewed missions beyond the moon into deep space. So we'll start. We'll start by sending astronauts to an asteroid for the first time in history. By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it. But I want to repeat this. Critical to deep space exploration will be the development of breakthrough propulsion systems and other advanced technologies. So I'm challenging NASA to break through these barriers. And we'll give you the resources to break through these barriers. And I know you will, with ingenuity and intensity, because that's what you've always done. Now, I understand that some believe that we should attempt a return to the surface of the moon first, as previously planned. But I just have to say, pretty bluntly here, we've been there before. Buzz has been there. There's a lot more of space to explore and a lot more to learn when we do. So I believe it's more important to ramp up our capabilities to reach and operate at a series of increasingly demanding targets while advancing our technological capabilities with each step forward. And that's what this strategy does. And that's how we will ensure that our leadership in space is even stronger in this new century than it was in the last. Now, finally, I want to say a few words about jobs. Suzanne pointed out to me the last time I was here, I made a very clear promise that I would help in the transition into a new program to make sure that people who are already going through a tough time here in this region were helped. And despite some reports to the contrary, my plan will add more than 2,500 jobs along the Space Coast in the next 2 years compared to the plan under the previous administration. So I want to make that point. We're going to modernize the Kennedy Space Center, creating jobs as we upgrade launch facilities. And there's potential for even more jobs as companies in Florida and across America compete to be part of a new space transportation industry. And some of those industry leaders are here today. And this holds the promise of generating more than 10,000 jobs nationwide over the next few years. And many of these jobs will be created right here in Florida because this is an area primed to lead in this competition. Now, it's true. There are Floridians who will see their work on the shuttle end as the program winds down. It was based on a decision that was made 6 years ago, not 6 months ago. But that doesn't make it any less painful for families and communities affected as this decision becomes reality. So I'm proposing, in part because of strong lobbying by Bill and by Suzanne, as well as Charlie, I'm proposing a $40 million initiative led by a high-level team from the White House, NASA, and other agencies to develop a plan for regional economic growth and job creation. And I expect this plan to reach my desk by August 15th. It's an effort that will help prepare this already skilled workforce for new opportunities in the space industry and beyond. So this is the next chapter that we can write together here at NASA. We will partner with industry. We will invest in cutting-edge research and technology. We will set far-reaching milestones and provide the resources to reach those milestones. And step by step, we will push the boundaries, not only of where we can go, but what we can do. Now, 50 years after the creation of NASA, our goal is no longer just a destination to reach. Our goal is the capacity for people to work and learn and operate and live safely beyond the Earth for extended periods of time, ultimately in ways that are more sustainable and even indefinite. And in fulfilling this task, we will not only extend humanity's reach in space, we will strengthen America's leadership here on Earth. Now, I'll close by saying this. I know that some Americans have asked a question that's particularly apt on tax day. Why spend money on NASA at all? Why spend money solving problems in space when we don't lack for problems to solve here on the ground? And obviously, our country is still reeling from the worst economic turmoil we've known in generations. We have massive structural deficits that have to be closed in the coming years. But you and I know this is a false choice. We have to fix our economy. We need to close our deficits. But for pennies on the dollar, the space program has fueled jobs and entire industries. For pennies on the dollar, the space program has improved our lives, advanced our society, strengthened our economy, and inspired generations of Americans. And I have no doubt that NASA can continue to fulfill this role. But that is why... But I want to say clearly to those of you who work for NASA, but to the entire community that has been so supportive of the space program in this area, that is exactly why it's so essential that we pursue a new course and that we revitalize NASA and its mission, not just with dollars, but with clear aims and a larger purpose. A little more than 40 years ago, astronauts descended the 9-rung ladder of the lunar module called Eagle. and allow their feet to touch the dusty surface of the Earth's only moon. This was the culmination of a daring and perilous gambit, of an endeavor that pushed the boundaries of our knowledge, of our technical prowess, of our very capacity as human beings to solve problems. It wasn't just the greatest achievement in NASA's history, it was one of the greatest achievements in human history. And the question for us now is whether that was the beginning of something or the end of something. I choose to believe it was only the beginning. So thank you. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
And to the sounds of the big band there, which was actually pre-recorded. It wasn't the real band there at all. That was Barack Obama outlining his vision for the future of space. Now, Michael, you've heard that talk. What did you think of it?
Well, I think as you said, it certainly didn't live up to Kennedy-esque type of speech, but I guess that was the intention. It was trying to aspire to something along those lines, to try and inspire people and try and get himself out of a bit of hot water, I think, with the locals.
Not successfully.
But not successfully, you tell us. And it was interesting when we highlighted a little bit of that on the Space Show a couple of weeks back. We did note that the speech given by the current NASA administrator certainly sort of towed the line and was very much, from what was said there, you would think that the NASA administration was at least publicly supporting the Obama administration's views. But I guess that's not... Not all that surprising, really, given the circumstances that he found himself in. But anyway.
One of the things I did when there was I attended a rally, a political rally, at a place called COCO, which is very near the Kennedy Space Center. And there were politicians there and astronauts and preachers and musicians. I think I may have described it before a few weeks ago, a cross between a Billy Graham rally of
That's
the 1950s
right.
and
yes.
a political rally and a football club sort of meeting. But more about, I've actually recorded that, and we will have that on a future space show, and that gives another take on just what is happening in America's space program. But we're well and truly out of time here. We're going to hand over to Mark and his program, Purple Haze. I'm Andrew Rennie.
And I'm Michael Abdillah.
And the Space Show will be back next Wednesday at 7:00.